I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Travel experts expect a big bump in summer travel this year and predict it to be the best year for travel since the recession.
We've had what, 4 or 5 years of basically no one taking a vacation, so this is the first summer that people are actually thinking about going somewhere, and I think that, you know, it's kind of a long overdue thing.
National Geographic editor-at-large and consumer advocate Chris Elliott joins the program to talk about the impact a booming travel season will have on Central Florida and about his new book. But first, as protests continue in Venezuela, concern is growing among the expatriate community here in Central Florida. I'll be joined by WLRN Miami Herald News America's correspondent Tim Padgett and Venezuelan activists Ricardo Spear and Juan Carlos Moreno to discuss the unrest in Venezuela and what the future looks like for the country. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined on the phone by Tim Padgett. Tim is a WLRN Miami Herald's America's correspondent. Tim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined in the studio here at WMFE by Juan Moreno, an attorney with Pius, Pius & Pius. Juan, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
And also we're joined by Ricardo Spear here in the studio. Ricardo's sister Monica was a UCF graduate and former Miss Venezuela. She was murdered while traveling to Venezuela in January. Ricardo, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Well, Tim, I want to begin with you. You cover Latin American affairs for WLRN. Can you just give us an overview? How did these protests begin?
Well, the protests began largely led by students out in western Venezuela in response to an assault on a female student. And it sort of brought all the frustrations about the rampant violent crime in Venezuela to a boiling point. Venezuela, as you may know, has South America's worst violent crime rate, worst murder rate. It also has Venezuela's worst inflation rate. So these protests are an accumulated response to the social and economic crisis that have been boiling over in Venezuela the past few years, and directed at the Maduro government, the socialist government in Venezuela, which many of the protesters accuse of sort of having an authoritarian left-wing agenda that they're trying to cram down the country's throat. And this has all come to a head now.
How is that different from when Hugo Chavez was in power?
Well, one of the differences, one of the ironies here is that it was Hugo Chavez's regime, which lasted for 14 years until his death last year, that really brought on the problems, economic mismanagement, an utter inability to handle the violent crime, and all these things that really sort of have sort of nullified any of the positive advances that his socialist regime made in terms of reducing poverty, empowering the poor, et cetera. The problem for President Maduro, Nicolas Maduro, is that he has none of the charisma that Hugo Chavez had, and he has very little ability then to engage the public during a crisis like this, and that's only made it worse.
Is it a simple case of two sides facing off here, or is it a little more nuanced and complex than that?
Well, it's a little more complex, but you make a good point. People, you know, they look at these problems that Venezuela has, and their initial assumption would be, well, then this is sort of the whole country would be upset, and the whole country might be upset, but you have to understand that this is also a very bitterly polarized and divided country socially and politically. In Venezuela, all you have to do is look at Caracas and the nature of the protests there. Many of the protests taking place at the capital in Caracas are being initiated out on the east side, the more affluent, more middle class east side of Caracas, which is pretty much 100% anti Chavez. You go to the west side of Caracas, though, and the poorer, more working class section of the capital. That's where the socialist government's base is. And even those who might be against the government are a little more hesitant to sort of come out into the street against the government. So that's the dynamic you've got working here. That's why those of us who have been watching these protests, you know, our conclusion is really that these protests aren't likely to bring the overthrow of the government, say, the way you saw in Ukraine. I think the protesters' aim here is probably going to have to be to get the government to sit down and negotiate with them about how to change policy to fix these terrible problems in Venezuela.
One, if I could bring you in now, you've become an activist in the situation. There are reports of a crippling shortage of basic needs like food and toiletries, for example, in Venezuela. What are the feelings of expatriates here in Central Florida?
The best thing that we can do is trying to make a voice, be an echo about this situation, because we need to make clear to all the government or the senators in Florida to raise our voice in the Congress, because we need support. Venezuela needs support, and right now there is only two Latin American countries that have raised the voice supporting Venezuela, but none of the South American, well, just one, but most of the South American countries and Central American countries are not supporting Venezuela, and neither is the United States right now. There is only few of opinions supporting the situation that Venezuela is suffering. About what happened between Chavez and Maduro, I believe the situation in Venezuela has become to this point because neither Chavez nor Maduro, they respect the separation of powers. The president is the one who makes decisions. The president, even when he's the chief of the executive power, they legislate from the seat and they punish from the seat. It's like the justice is only in the hands of the president, and that one is something that cannot be supported. The difference was Chavez has more charisma and more power than Maduro has. Maduro not only doesn't have any education at all, is not prepared to direct any department, not the country, but not any department of the government.
With that in mind, how do you see things playing out in Venezuela? Does that make the situation more volatile and more dangerous for Venezuelans than it would have been had Chavez still been in power at this point?
I believe so, yes. And also, the situation is getting to a point that if the people stop right now, what is going to happen is going to be worse, because Maduro will be in the power, fixed in the power forever. But I believe it has to be a dialogue. They have to talk about what other venues they can raise, because this is a point that if there is not a negotiation, it can become a civil war.
Mm-hmm. Tim, can I bring you back onto into the conversation now? What about the conditions, though, that kicked this all off? Do you think there was something like this brewing even while Chavez was in power?
Yes, and I think we saw a lot of there were incidents of the kind that happened, the tragedy that happened to Ms. Spear, for example, and the economy. You know, we were seeing toilet paper and rice shortages even when Chavez was president. Chavez was able to hold things together a little bit better. After he died, however, Maduro just did not have the political skills to help people forget about these crises. He wasn't able to handle it as well as Chavez, and that's why things have been spiraling. And Ms. Spears and her ex-husband's murders then really became the focal point, and then all it needed was just, you know, a spark, and that's what happened out in Western Caracas back in February when this other young woman was assaulted.
What about the U.S. response? President Obama has been urged by policymakers like Florida Governor Rick Scott, Senator Marco Rubio, to take diplomatic action against the government of Venezuela. We've also got Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz saying that the president is considering economic sanctions on the country. How effective do you think sanctions would be against Venezuela?
Not very, and I'm not the only journalist down here to say it. We could stop importing oil from Venezuela. They would still find a place to sell it. This is not Cuba. There's been a lot of attempts by Florida politicians to try to turn this into the new Cuba issue. They're just not the same issues. I'm not saying that the United States shouldn't be addressing the Venezuela crisis. It should. And I'm not saying that there are real problems with this government. It's a democratically elected government, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it governs democratically, and that's a big part of the reason we're seeing these protests. But I think the United States has to approach Venezuela in a bit of a more nuanced way. I think one of the most effective things it could do right now is try to find a credible mediator in this situation that could get the Maduro government and the opposition to sit down and start hashing out these issues so that, as you said before, so that we don't get to the point of a civil war.
Does anybody, any country or any mediator spring to mind thinking about that?
Well, one of the ideas that's been bandied about right now, as I reported last week, is the Pope. A lot of people think it's time for the Pope to start to step up and start being the first Latin American Pope. And he's got more. He's got credibility with both sides. He's also got the diplomatic goods. His Secretary of State was most recently a papal nuncio in Venezuela. So he knows the country. He's got some credibility there. So a lot of people feel maybe the Vatican should be the one to step in.
How do you think Maduro's government would respond to that?
Well, as I said, I think the church in Venezuela doesn't have that much credibility with the Chavista government, but the Vatican, I think, does. And so I think that this might be a solution that would be palatable to both the Maduro government and the opposition.
We've been speaking to Tim Padgett. He's WLRN Miami Herald's America's correspondent. Tim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about the situation in Venezuela with Ricardo Spear, whose sister Monica was shot and killed during a robbery in Venezuela in January. And we're also talking to Juan Carlos Moreno, who's working to shed light on the situation in Venezuela. Ricardo, the idea of bringing the Pope in there, I mean, is that something that you've heard talked about before? Does that seem like a viable gambit?
That is actually the first time that I've heard of that, you know, possibility. But when I think about it, Chavez always played on the church. He always called out on the church and saying, you know, God. And that's how he reached a large demographics. And so the church or the Vatican coming in would definitely help out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Juan, let me ask you, if it's not the Pope, then is there another country in South America or Central America you think could step up and help try and resolve things?
Well, at this point, there are two countries that has offered the way to resolve the situation. There are Panama and Chile. And also the ex-president of Colombia has supported the situation. Of course, he is more sided to the opposition side than to Maduro's side. But in order to find somebody that can be a mediator could be, I believe, either Panama or Chile.
Mm-hmm. You see either of those countries as being countries that would actually be able to get the ear of the Maduro government and do some good?
Well, at this point, I don't think Panama will be because he broke relationship with Panama. But mm-hmm. Chile is still there.
Do you see, though, I mean, when you were in Venezuela last, or just even looking at the country now, do you think is there any sign that what was a massive base of support for Chavez could start to crumble, given what's happening now with Maduro? I mean, does Maduro have less support from the Chavistas that Chavez once had?
It seems that what's happening is, with Chavez, he got so charisma that nobody was able to see the bad part of the government. Maduro doesn't have that charisma. And right now, everybody's looking at that. They think that every poor people is with him, and it's not. It's not. Because those people are the people that suffer more. They have the people that have to do the longest lane. They have the people, when I mean longest lane, is because there is a complete shortage of basic products.
Sure.
And you go to the, like when I was in Venezuela, in 16 days, I had my coffee with liquid milk, like gallon milk. I never saw gallon milk there, never liquid milk. That's the shortage that we have in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. No toilet paper. I have to, at that time, when we used to send gift to the family in Venezuela, for the last month, we have sent toilet paper, soap, toothpaste. That's the situation in Venezuela. And the poor people, they don't have any way to reach those products better than, because the people that have more money, they pay three times the value of the product, but they don't do the lane.
Mm-hmm.
Who is suffering more? The poor people.
Well, what do you see happening if there can't be some mediation or something within a month or two? Do you think the situation is going to get much worse than it is now?
I hope no, but I think it could be, because the people are reacting very, very aggressive lately. And I'm going to say that it's both sides right now being aggressive. And I believe the government should control the situation without the use of the guns or without the use of those collectives, because what they are creating is making reaction on the same way. And that's why I think if there is not going to be any solution soon, then it's going to be a civil war coming. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion.
Ricardo, let me just come back to you. You mentioned in an earlier interview with one of our reporters here at WMFE, you said, "I feel like this needed to happen." You're referring there to the death of your sister. And you said you felt like something would result from this. What did you mean by that?
What I meant is that I was hoping that it would open people's eyes to what was happening, and something needed to happen in order to get internationalized, in order to encourage people to go out on the street, and it's been happening. You know, I'm hoping that within the next few months, either, you know, there's dialogue, which I really doubt, because that's not how the Venezuelan government has worked in the past. I mean, it might be a lot of manipulation saying, oh, let's have a call for peace, but then they call the opposition fascist and violent, you know. And so that is just really an insult. Now, I'm not sure if the people in Venezuela are going to be able to hold out to protest, you know, every day like they've been doing so for the past few months because of the economic power. I don't think that they have the ability to buy food without, you know, being able to go to work. And that's a big concern. And that's why the students are the ones pushing the revolution or the change. I'm hoping that, you know, something happens. I mean, that's just it.
Do you think there's a future in Venezuela for you, or do you think that door is closed now?
Currently, I don't believe that there's a lot of opportunities. I mean, there is, but you have to go through the ways of corruption, and that's not something I'm up for. There are a lot of opportunities for improvement.
Are either of you planning to visit Venezuela anytime soon?
I'm going on April 18.
Mm-hmm. Are you fearful at all? Any sort of trepidation about making that trip?
If the situation continues, I'm not going to go. I'm going to cancel my trip because I love Venezuela. I want to do my best for Venezuela, but I think I do better here than going there, because there I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to be another victim suffering from the government or the system. I'd rather stay here.
Mm-hmm. Ricardo, how about yourself?
I hope to be able to move back within the next few years and do something about, you know, make the improvements I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And you both have family in Venezuela still?
Correct.
Yes. So, I mean, that must make the situation pretty difficult and stressful to deal with, I imagine.
It is. I mean, my aunt got robbed a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, and it just, it's every day I literally wake up and say, you know, how are you guys doing? You know, how are the things? And they just kept telling me that yesterday the collectives, you know, they were planning to come around, but they spilled oil on the street so they wouldn't be able to get in and stuff like that. I mean, hopefully I've had, you know, well news for the people that I know, but I know that there's some people that are not as fortunate.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in. We've been speaking to Juan Carlos Moreno, an attorney with Pius, Pius & Pius. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you also to Ricardo Spear for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Up next, a conversation with National Geographic travel editor and consumer advocate Chris Elliott. I'm joined in the studio by Christopher Elliott. Christopher is the editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. His latest book is How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler and Save Time, Money, and Hassle. Christopher, thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Well, first of all, according to a Travelers United study, 8 out of 10 Americans said they were planning to travel this summer, suggesting that this could be maybe the greatest resurgence for travel since the Great Recession. What do you think accounts for this upcoming busy summer?
Well, you know, I think that it's been, we've had, what, 4 or 5 years of basically no one taking a vacation. So this is the first summer that people are actually thinking about going somewhere. And I think that, you know, it's kind of a long overdue thing. So that's what the research is showing, is that people are finally planning to go somewhere.
How do cities like Orlando, with its theme parks, factor into this? Do you think people are more likely to travel within the United States than splash out on a big overseas trip?
Well, you know, Orlando is one of the top 3 or 4 destinations for inbound international travel. So, you know, you're talking about two different things here. You're talking about trips that Americans are taking to other places and trips that people from outside the states are taking to here. I think that when it comes to Americans, we just have put off having a vacation for so long that we really, at this point, don't care where we go. Whether it's a weekend staycation somewhere during the summer or if we're going to Europe. I think that It's very difficult to generalize and say, you know, we're all taking a vacation to Orlando, or we're all going to New York or something like that. But in terms of inbound destination traffic, Orlando, it seems to be somewhere between number three and number four. It's competing with destinations like Las Vegas and New York and Los Angeles and Miami too.
And yet it's still getting something in the line of 57 million visitors a year. That's quite a big number, even if it's number three or four.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we do a lot of things right here in Orlando. I've been here for the last 10 years. I've called Orlando home, and I get to see firsthand. We take our kids to the park. And when I say park, I don't mean that we're taking them to the park across the street. We take them to the parks like Universal and Disney and SeaWorld. And we see firsthand how Orlando is kind of like the gold standard in customer service and in taking care of its tourists. So it's nice to see that, because I write about tourism all the time. I cover it. I cover customer service in particular. So it's good to see how it's done here, and it's really kind of a we're really role models here, I think, for the rest of the U.S. tourism industry.
Now, your book is packed with lots of interesting information. You talk a lot about how people are now relying a lot on online booking, bypassing the travel agent, just doing things themselves. I mean, that's been something which has been happening for a while. But I'm wondering, how is planning, do you think, for travel changed now that there is so much of this user-driven content available out on the internet?
Well, you're talking about TripAdvisor and Yelp,
sure,
and
yeah,
user-generated reviews. I think it's changed things a lot, and not necessarily for the better, because these sites are, in many cases, they're anonymous, so you don't know who's writing the reviews, and you don't know even what those people's priorities are, what their lifestyle is like, so you don't know if their recommendation is going to work for you. The thing that's problematic and that I learned in researching this book is that many people are just looking at one or two reviews and making a booking decision based on it. So they're going to TripAdvisor and they're looking, how many stars does this hotel have or destination have, and or restaurant, I should say. And then they're making a decision based strictly on that one review. And one of the things I say in this book is that you really have to cast a very wide net, because that's the only way that you're going to get really good, reliable advice. So go to the user-generated review sites. I'm not saying don't use them, but ask a friend. Go to a guidebook. Go to a media site, you know, a Frommer's or a Fodor's, and get advice from all kinds of places. Talk to a trusted travel agent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way that you're going to not make that mistake of making a reservation based strictly on an unvetted review and ending up in a place where you're disappointed, maybe.
What about the role of actual real-life travel agents? Is there still a place for a live travel agent?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, travel agents were left for dead a couple of years ago, which is too bad, because there are some really great travel agents out there. And I think that if you have – there are certain types of trips that you really don't want to try to book alone. If you're doing an around-the-world itinerary – that can get very complex very quickly. So my advice would be, use a good travel agent. And there are a couple of other times too. A destination wedding, for instance, you definitely want to use someone who knows what they're doing. But then there are also some where you don't want to bother a travel agent. For instance, a simple point-to-point trip, an Amtrak trip somewhere. You know, you don't want to bother an agent. You just go onto the website and book the trip.
Mm-hmm. You have a chapter on safety. I'm just wondering, is there anywhere in the world that's truly safe for a traveler?
Yeah, your own living room, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things I say in this book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler, is that if you want to have an absolutely sure thing, if you want to be absolutely safe, then you stay home. Of course, I'll eat my words, because you could always have a sinkhole and then it's game over. But
sure. Hurricane blow through,
tornado. We just had a big tornado warning the other day here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, there are safer destinations that you can go to, and then there are some that you definitely do want to avoid. One of the things I say in the book is you have to do your research. You've got to go to the State Department website and check it out. If you're flying to that place, don't assume that you're going to get a refund if the State Department tells all the Americans to get out, because that rather rarely happens. The airline would have to cancel the flight in order for you to get a refund. Mm-hmm. So do a little bit of research beforehand, and if you have misgivings, choose somewhere safer. You know, do a staycation, stay here at home.
We have a pretty big airport here in Orlando. Is that a good thing if you're looking to fly out of Central Florida? Is that kind of put more options at your disposal?
Oh, yeah. Well, I love the Orlando airport. It is actually one of the reasons that I'm here, is it's just a great airport to fly in and out of. It's not too expensive. You know, you've got some really good airlines running out of here. So yeah, it's good. And people come from all over Florida to fly out of Orlando. I just don't see a downside to it at all. Mm-hmm. I know that there's some expansion going on. It's all positive.
What about scanners? You write about scanners in this book. You're not a fan of the scanning technology.
No, some of that actually has already been unplugged, which is good, very positive for travelers. The problem with the TSA is that they have had this rule, and it was a knee-jerk reaction to the underwear bomber of a couple of years ago. And now if you're not part of the PreCheck program, which is their trusted traveler program, you have to go through one of these body scanners. And if you don't, they'll give you an enhanced pat down. I have to ask you, have you ever been patted down at the TSA checkpoint?
I don't recall, actually. if it's a memory, I've probably blocked it out.
Yeah, right. You probably would remember. It's a fairly intense process where they're using more force in the pat down than they maybe did in the past. They call it an enhanced pat down. So they're really touching every part of your body. A lot of people think that this is a violation of their civil rights. I happen to agree that enhanced pat downs really, unless you're in prison, they shouldn't be doing them. So we're moving right now to much more of a risk-based screening system where the people who are considered to be more of a risk are going to be going through those scanners. And everyone else gets to be scanned like they used to be, which is going through the magnetometers, not having to take your shoes off, putting your bag on the conveyor belt and sitting it through, that sort of thing. I just think the TSA probably they've been too reactive and not proactive enough. And that really it's slow to change. It's a very bureaucratic organization. And they don't like to explain themselves. So when you ask them why they're doing something, they're not likely to tell you. They're just going to say it's for security, and then that's it.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts on other tips people might want to keep in mind to be a safe and savvy traveler?
The book that I wrote is kind of an amalgamation of all the bad things that have happened to people over 20 years of helping solve travel problems. And I wish that I could hand this out at the airport. And if there was one thing that I could say, it would be just plan ahead a little bit. Call your airline to make sure your flight's leaving on time. Call to confirm your hotel reservation. 90% of the problems happen when people just assume things and they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So if you did just a little bit of advanced planning and verified that your flight is leaving on time or your hotel still has a reservation for you, you could probably avoid most of the problems.
I've been speaking to Christopher Elliott. He's the editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler. His latest book is How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. Christopher, thank you very much for talking to me.
It's been my pleasure.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.